This is the seventh in a series of eight lessons on the Sermon on the Mount. And the last lesson, I closed by sharing some thoughts about time. And I did that because in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus had indicated that sufficient unto the day was the evil thereof. And he talked about not being concerned about what happened yesterday or what would happen tomorrow. And he said to take no anxious thought, because by doing so you could not change one cubit of your stature or of your life. And what he was telling us was that there is a different kind of thinking in us that is above our thinking. He was telling us to repent, not to become aware that you're a poor, miserable sinner. That's not what repent meant, ever. It meant to think above your thinking, informing us that the message of all of the scriptures, from Genesis to Revelations, but most particularly in that great series of lessons that he conducted that had been called the Seminar on the Mount, he was showing us how to experience a state of being that already exists in every person. He wasn't telling us how to create a higher consciousness. He was saying that that higher consciousness already exists, and if you will do these things, you will have that experience. If you will practice these principles in your personal relationships and affairs, something absolutely incredible will happen to you. And one of the things that will happen will be that your understanding of time will change, that in our purely human condition, we think of time as linear or horizontal. If you were to draw time, you would draw it out on a line. But time, for us, is like that. We think of time as something that stretches out in front of us and stretches back behind us. Isn't that true? And it's measured in increments of the seconds and minutes and hours and days. And these are, a day is defined as the period of time that it takes for our planet to revolve on its axis, 24 hours. And a year is 365 and a little more of those revolutions, but it's also the time that it takes our planet to revolve completely around the sun. But Jesus was telling us that time is not what we have believed time to be. That in the universe, time as we understand time does not exist. That real time, time that we will come to understand in the fullness of our glory, is now. The words or the term that has been translated as eternal life did not mean eternal life at all. We think of eternal life as a series of years lived. A million years, maybe a billion years, a lot of years. That's eternal, isn't it? We're going to stretch out and live all those years. Not at all. In the real universe, there's only now. There's no time in time, and that's what aeonian time means, timeless time. But it's very important because we're talking about more than time. We're talking about a state of being in which everything is made new. We are renewed. Our old thinking passes away, and behold, a new thinking is experienced by us, is revealed to us. And from that experience, understanding, real understanding comes. In that experience, we know who we are. And in that experience, we are constantly in conscious contact with the Spirit of life, the Spirit of the universe. We are at one with God, and in our one with God, we are at one with each other. Our mind that lives in time cannot bear these thoughts and cannot understand these thoughts, because it is only when we escape from our ordinary minds, our ordinary consciousness, that we can follow the Christ, meaning to emulate and to become. And so this is what he is saying, that these truths, these principles that he is revealing and demonstrating in his own experience are about you having an experience that is your ultimate destiny, but moving into it now. Let's pick up with the 7th chapter of the book of Matthew. And these 5 short verses that I'm going to share, that contain about 100 words, is one of the most amazing documents that has ever been presented to the human race. In these 5 verses, we are told more about things that are important to us than all of the philosophies and theologies that have ever been put together have told us. Emmett Fox, in his great book, The Sermon on the Mount, says that this one short document tells you more about the nature of man and man's relationship with God, more about the meaning of life, the importance of conduct, the art of living, the secret of happiness and success, the way out of trouble, the approach to God, the emancipation of the soul, the salvation of the world, than you could ever possibly learn in any of the universities that exist. As a matter of fact, this teaching is not taught in the university. Let me read to you that great lesson. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck out of your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. I strongly suspect that the buildup that I gave to you before I read those 5 verses made those 5 verses somewhat disappointing, right? Admit it. Because what is so revolutionary about what I just read to you? Well, judge not that you be not judged, for with the judgment that you judge with, you shall be judged. And with what measure you measure the world around you, it shall be measured to you again. If any one of us really understood and truly believed how important this document is, it would revolutionize our conduct. We would change. Even those of us who believe we truly know what it means would begin to change again immediately. We would be transformed. Doesn't matter who we are. And so I want to urge us all this evening to listen with a new mind, with an open mind, as though you had never heard these words read or any idea of what they mean before in your life. The plain fact is that the law of life, I've just read it to you, says that as we feel and think and speak and act towards others, so will others feel and think and speak and act towards us. In other words, whatever sort of conduct we give out, we are inevitably bound to get it back. Anything and everything that we do to others will sooner or later be done to us by someone somewhere. The good that we do to others we shall receive back in like measure, except not exactly in like measure. It will come back to us, heaped up, pressed down, and running over. It will come back to us tenfold. And it's a double-edged sword, though, that we are working with the mind, the ungood that we do to others will come back to us. It is absolutely impossible to take advantage of another person in any way and not ultimately be taken advantage of yourself in exactly that same way, except to a larger or greater degree. It is impossible to say something that diminishes another person and not ultimately be diminished yourself. It will come. It cannot fail to come. It will happen. It will happen. Now, more often than not, we don't see it happen, and almost never does it come from the source or from the person that we give it to in the first place. It always comes in a different way and at some future time, but do not believe that it will not come. It will. This principle has led us to believe in the impractical concept that God is that unpleasant person in the sky with the huge blackboard and a chalk marker who is recording all the things and says, aha, I caught you, I saw you. There, zap, you've got you. And I know what you're thinking, and I've got that too. Here it is, you've got it again. The principle is the same, but it isn't God in the sense of a reigning monarch who is a despot and is watching over all the sinners and causing them to be punished. This law is really a very positive and wonderful law that works in our behalf, and it really is a law, and the universe, infinite intelligence as it works in the universal subjective mind, is like a giant computer, and we are plugged into that computer. Your mind thinks and feels into that larger computer, and every thought and feeling is recorded, the kind, the nature of it. It's like any computer that maintains a data bank, and you have a data bank in the giant computer, and it will surely come back to you. And isn't that wonderful? When we begin to understand what's happening, when we begin to get the hang of it, because if we really did believe that what we sent out came back, would our conversation change? Would you watch your words and thoughts and correct them? Would you? Moment by moment? With what measure you use, it will be measured to you again. You know, one of the things that the human psyche believes is that our security comes from gathering our part of the world's goods and collecting it and accumulating it and keeping your hands off of it. This is mine. Now, where's yours? That is insecurity. That's the mind that believes in having. And when a person believes in having, meaning gathering all there is to oneself, time, all that we have is what we have, and all that we have is our own self. If you think about yourself long enough, and if your thrust in life is in gathering things for yourself and for the security of you and your family, in time, your world will cave in on itself. And the law says that all that you have gathered will be lost. It is only what we give that we can ultimately keep. It is only what goes out from us that comes back. Now, does this mean that one should not have possessions and should not be prosperous? Not at all. But it is done from a different perspective, from the reaching out and the sending forth and the sharing and the giving and the prospering and the growing. It is so important to understand this law of retribution, which is not a law of retribution at all. It's a law that rewards us for what we give. And it's very positive and spiritual. But you and I, in our spiritual growth, begin to make other people as important as we ourselves are to ourselves. An astonishing thing begins to happen. In time, other people become more important to you than you ever were to you. And the more you give of yourself to other persons, now I'm not talking about the kind of giving that comes from weakness in which we are constantly seeking other person's approval. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that sense of awareness, the feeling of love and of caring for others. In my own experience, I can recall that in the depth of my despair and hopelessness, I lived in a small circle. I stood in the middle of a small circle, and there was only me, and I could only think about me and what others had not done for me. That was my sickness. And in time, all I had was me, and I couldn't bear me. And then when my experience with Aeonian time, with timeless time, came, the most amazing transformation that took place was I suddenly discovered that I loved people. It was not that I loved people, it was that God loved people through me. And where moments before I was the object of my attention and affection, you became the object of my attention and affection. And the more I loved people, the more people there were in my life. It is astonishing that how we begin to accumulate that which we love, that which goes forth. With what measure you meet, and I know that it's true, I know that it is real, and that it is an incredible law of life that sets us free when properly practiced, but binds us and wounds us when not fully understood. And that all of the wounds that we have come from not understanding the law. And this is what Jesus the Christ was saying to us. You shall know this truth, and it will set you free. And what it sets us free from is our own self. Harold Sherman said that your five physical senses can report only what has happened or will happen again, since they are restricted solely to contact with the world outside yourself. But these inner, higher senses were designed to help you see and apprehend and create new worlds, not only here but hereafter, as the consciousness that is you continues its evolutionary journey through time and space, seeking someday somewhere a self-conscious union with God consciousness. The consciousness that is you is at this moment continuing its evolutionary journey through time and space, through timeless time. That's what we're reaching for, so that we will experience something that is above time, above our ordinary experience. You are not ordinary. If you think that you're ordinary, that is an illusion. That is not a reality. You are extraordinary. You are more extraordinary than you can possibly conceive in 1,000 lifetimes. 1,000 lifetimes of hard work will not reveal to you the glory of you, and it is not a glory that you can take credit for. It is a glory that exists in your true reality. Anyhow, as we are working with these principles, have you noticed that sometimes we send out our good to someone so that we can get their attention and get their approval? Have you ever tried that little game. It doesn't work, does it? And that's something that's very important that we understand, that if we give our good, our kind or thoughtful remarks to a person seeking recognition from that person at the human level, then all that we have is the recognition of the person or at the human level. We do not reap the spiritual benefits. It's only when we do what we do because we have no choice but to do it. I first discovered this shortly after the experience that I mentioned to you. My life changed so dramatically that I could hardly stand it, and it was noticeable to people. When your personality shifts as mine did, there's some folks that are looking on that don't believe it and don't even really like it, but they didn't like it before anyhow, so that hasn't changed all that much. A couple of my friends, quote-unquote, came to me and said that this change in me was really working to my disadvantage, and that if I did not watch myself carefully, that the change would get me in trouble. And I wondered what kind of trouble I could get into that was worse than the trouble I'd just gotten out of. You know, how could it get me in? Well, you understand what I'm saying. But it did concern me, and so I asked the question, is it possible to feel too good? Is it possible to love too much? Is it possible to practice these principles to such an extent that tomorrow you will reap a negative reward? I dare not feel any better today because I might be equally depressed tomorrow. You've had that thought, haven't you? The day that you were depressed, it was because you felt so good yesterday, and so the law was, don't feel too good because it will make you feel bad tomorrow. That is not a law at all. That is an illusion. That is something that we have created. And so I asked the question. I wrote it out and I said, God, reveal it to me. And I wanted to know. It's important that I know. And a day or two passed and I found myself driving through the small town of Radford, Virginia. Now you can drive through Radford, Virginia and hardly notice it at all. It's about the size of this property which we find ourselves. But as I was tooling down that highway through Radford, Virginia, I happened to look over, and on my right side there was the public library, about the size of a large service station. And I felt an incredible urge to go in that public library. Now, I cannot tell you how strange that feeling was, because I did not spend very much time those days in public libraries, particularly in Radford, Virginia. I drove a quarter of a mile or some distance and felt the urge, and I turned that car around and came in and parked and went inside, and the librarian said, may I help you? And it was rather embarrassing for me to be in a library. I was not the library type, and I said, no thank you, I'm looking for a certain book. I didn't know what I was looking for. And as I walked back away from where she was, I reached up on a shelf and removed a book and opened it. It was Emerson's Essays. And the one to which I opened was on the law of compensation. And I let me tell you, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up now as I repeat the story to you. Because my answer was there. I opened to the answer. There it was. In this incredible universe, it is impossible to love too much or give too much or feel too much joy. Because from the good that goes from you, all that you will get will be an equivalent that comes back, providing that it is not done for personal advantage. It will come to you. And that's what Jesus was saying. Give it all that you've got. Shortly thereafter, I came across Lloyd C. Douglas' great book, The Magnificent Obsession, and read it and was enthralled. And then in that very same year, the movie came out, and I've viewed it many times. To give because we were created to give, and to love because we were created to love, and to do good without thought of recompense, although you know that the recompense will come, and seeking no credit at all. And the magnificent obsession was just that, to give, and if you get found out, it doesn't count. Pray that you don't get found out. Do you know that the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox was the early textbook of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And the magnificent obsession had great impact on the early founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous was never meant, the word, the term, the name was never meant be anonymous so that people won't know that you have had this disease. Anonymity was that we were to do our good works in secret so that God could reward us openly, that we were to carry the message of the spiritual life and of this possibility for the reformation, for the transformation of our very souls to other persons who still suffered, but to do so seeking no personal credit or recognition, that all credit and glory went to God. And that was the basic principle. And that basic principle is not Christian. It just is. It's a living part of the universe. All of the great religions have understood. And their mystics and prophets and adherents have practiced this wisdom, this reality. What we give comes back. Now, suppose, though, that you have lived a life in which you haven't done so very well. You haven't practiced it so pretty good. And you've got a lot of garbage out there. What are you going to do about it? If it is true that everything that you send out comes back, then you and I have accumulated a lot of stuff, haven't we? Early on, I came to understand that I did not want to live under the law of justice. Is there anybody in this room that wants justice? You want justice? Ooh, you've got a problem, friend. If you want justice, what we want is mercy. Mercy, the unmerited grace of God forgiving us this day, this hour, this moment of Aeonian time for all of the trespasses that we have ever committed. And the good news is that when we do what? Only when we forgive others of their trespasses are we forgiven ourselves. And here again is the law of what measure you meet. We cannot be forgiven until we forgive other persons. Isn't that wonderful? Karma, the word karma may shock members of a Christian community because it sounds like a Hindu or Eastern philosophy that is anti-Christian. You know that the word karma comes from the Sanskrit word, which means come back. That's all it means, come back. That which goes out comes back, which is a universal principle. And it's not just the bad that comes back. Everything that we send out comes back. But one of the most exciting phrases that I heard early on in my life is that Christ, now Christ in the Bible is not the same as Jesus. Jesus is the name of a person who experienced or who demonstrated or who became or who is the Christ. Christ means the mind of God appearing in a person. Christ is the perfect expression of an idea. The perfect idea of a person. The perfect person is Christ. But the perfect person is the mind of God in a person. And you can sort of get the hang of this when you remember that Jesus said, "It is not I, but the Father within me." It is something more than I am. The Father is greater than I. The Father in me is the perfect self that I am, but that you are also. Now, that perfect self in you is king of karma, meaning it can cancel all of your debts, all the negatives, instantly, and does. It can cancel any erroneous concepts that we have of ourselves, including that we are diseased. That perfect self of us knows that we cannot die, and will know it and will experience it consciously the day we step out of this physical form in which we find ourselves. I behold the Christ in you. It's a statement or an affirmation that has great power, because the only part of me that can behold the perfect part of you is the Christ. And when I am at one with that self of me, I am at one with you and you with me. And are you getting the hang of what I'm saying? And so this is what Jesus was saying to us in that text. If you think that you're the one that's got it, but your brother doesn't, you better check that out, friend, is what he was saying. You're looking at the log that's in your brother's eye, and like so many religious persons, it seems that the more religious we get, the more we know that we're better than others. They are the ones that need saving. Have you ever noticed that the religious are always questioning whether you were fixed or not? And he was saying, no. Look, check it out, sweetheart, because what you're seeing in your brother and your sister is really in you. And only that larger self of you can cancel it. But if you really don't think you have a problem, that is your great problem. I have never seen anyone get fixed until they were broken. We won't change if we stand tall and erect in our goodness. It is not until we can see that our fellow person, whatever it is that they have, we have had it, or we have it, or we're subject to having it again, that we are no better than they, that they too have within them this innate perfection. And we will bear the burden of each other, and we'll bear each other's burdens until each of us achieve that perfection, that I cannot get there because I am good and you are less good. We will get there because we are rising up together, holding each other's hand, so to speak, into the perfection that is already ours to experience. Jesus continues in his great lesson. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, does it? What does that have to do with us today? Dogs, and swine, and pearls? Well, remember that he was speaking in metaphor. He was talking to the people in his time in a way that they could understand. If it's true that your consciousness, the sweetness of your spirit, that this mind that's in you now that's filled with hope and clarity and joy and peace that you've had to work so hard to achieve, and I can tell you that if you are at peace with yourself and your brothers and your sisters, it's only because you have worked very hard for a long time, and you have suffered greatly, and you have risen, and you have striven with all your might and main to rise up out of the pig pen of your own life, and therefore this pearl of wisdom and love is precious. It is of great price. It is of great value because of what you've paid to achieve it. It is the most precious thing that you can have, because it becomes your future, if you have a future. He's saying, don't take this thing that you have and show it to dogs, meaning to people that really won't know what they see, to depraved persons, really what it means. And don't give your pearls to swine. Why not? What was he trying to say? Have you ever been in a pig pen? I mean, like really a pig pen, not the one that you were in, but the one where the pigs really are. Have you noticed that it's pretty mucky? That's the nice word for it, in a pig pen. Pretty mucky there, isn't it? Now, you're going to take your sweet, wonderful, precious consciousness into the pig pen and show it to the pigs. First thing you know, you will drop it. I promise you that you will, in the muck and the mire. And then when you get down on your knees trying to find it, you will discover that they will turn and rend you. And meaning, you know, pigs have tusks or tushes, you know? Guess where they will rend you? Have any idea? You're right. That's exactly where you get it. And that's exactly where you got it. Take your most precious idea. What happens to us when we come into the spiritual life? You want to know what happens? We get so excited, so caught up with ourselves, with our excitement, with our joy, with this newly discovered self. And immediately we know certain people that really do need fixing. Our kids and our parents and our spouses, if we still have them. And more especially if we don't, they need fixing. And so we pounce on them. We descend upon them. We're going to carry to them this great wisdom, this wonderful thing that will change them, right? Oh, have you tried it? Do you know what happens? In a short time, you will have lost it. Try to give it to somebody that doesn't want it, because they really don't want you, and they're not ready for it. Within 5 or 10 or 15 minutes at the max, you will have lost it. You will have lost your joy. You will have lost your excitement. And when you get down on your knees in that pig pen trying to get it, you will find that they will turn and rend you then and later. They will say, I had the strangest conversation with her or him. You think they were goofy before? You should see them now after they've got this incredible religion, which is not a religion at all. And we learn in this way. I looked in the concordance today, and I was amazed to discover how many times and how many instances that Jesus said, go your way and tell no one. Go your way and tell no one. The blind man was healed. He said, don't tell anyone. The other persons were healed. He said, don't tell anybody about it. Why? Because you will lose it. You will lose your healing. You will begin to disbelieve it yourself. They will talk you out of it. Have you ever had an experience of having a very religious person discover that you have somehow been changed, or that you've come to this or some other church, and they descend upon you and begin to question your newly found religiosity, and they have all the scriptures by heart to prove that you... Do you know what I'm talking about? Please, with all the earnestness at my command, let me urge you to never get into that kind of a conversation with anyone. You will always lose every time. Have you ever won? You never shall. There's only one way that you can prove these principles, and that's by becoming them. That's by practicing them. In time, you will draw to you the people that will use you as their example. In the meantime, Jesus said, go your way and tell no one. Didn't mean to not share it with other like-minded persons, because when you and I share our experience together, we empower each other, don't we? We reinforce each other. But let's impose it on those who do not want it, because they don't believe in us. They have seen our inconsistencies over many months and years. And what makes us think that when we inflict them with our new thoughts, and that's really what we do, that we're any better than those who have pounced upon us with their religiosity? In time, God will get to them. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I'll fix them. You leave them alone. You've got all the work that you can possibly take care of by managing yourself. One of the fears that I had when I came into this way of life was that I would lose my friends. And guess what? I was right. I lost all my friends. One by one and slowly, and there was just a drifting away. And then to my amazement, I discovered that my friends had never really been my friends at all. You cannot lose your friends. But there will be a change. There will be an adjustment. There will be. There has to be. Does this mean that we are better than our former friends? Not at all. Remember the speck and the log. We're not better because we're practicing spiritual principles. In time, we draw to us people that we meet, that we need to walk the path with us, and the people that we can help. Now, there's one or two exceptions when in this matter of not carrying the message to people who are not ready to hear it. And a good example of that would be that people who are experiencing alcoholism, other diseases. In my life, I have never seen a person change until they experience the consequences of their unacceptable behavior. And it used to be that we thought that we had to wait until people made up their minds to stop drinking or get sober or get off of drugs. And the principle that I'm talking about also applies to our children. When we have direct responsibility for other people's lives as employers and as family members, the time will invariably come when we will have to conduct what has come to be known as an intervention, when we have to really face them and say, you are acceptable and I love you, but your behavior, your disease, this thing that you're doing is totally unacceptable to me and to us. That oftentimes produces a conscious shock in a person's life. It brings them to a point of change. Very important to know and to pray about those opportunities. It is a responsibility that we have. And we're not so much trying to convert them to our way of thinking, but to not accept their unacceptable behavior as a pattern in my life. If I had to give up my goofiness, do you think I want to live with somebody else's goofiness? No. And I will not. There's a magic in loving those people at that moment, loving and caring enough to go to people and saying, I too have had your experience. It's not acceptable to me when I had it, and I was not acceptable to others. And I found a way to change, and you can too. What is it that will make people ultimately want to be like us? Only one thing. Next week, I'll begin our lesson by discussing at some greater length what this thing is. It's to become the truth. Not to have studied it, not just to read it, not to pray about it, but to become it. And in becoming it, to create and to recreate our world, to become such a dynamic example of the Spirit of God in action that everything changes. R.L. Sharp wrote a poem that I would share with you in closing. It's called The Builders. Isn't it strange that princes and kings and clouds that caper in sawdust rings and common people like you and me are builders for eternity? Each is given a bag of tools, a shapeless mass, a book of rules, and each must make, ere life is flown, a stumbling block or a stepping stone. I think that's what Jesus was talking about, the Sermon on the Mount. We're all the same no matter where we are in life, and we are builders for eternity. And each of us has been given a bag of tools, the mental and emotional powers that we have, and a shapeless mass, which is our life when we move into it, and a book of rules, the principles outlined in the Sermon on the Mount and other great treatises. We must create from this raw material a new world. And I'll tell you, when we do, the world, at least a few people in it, will be the path to your door. We must become the movers and the shakers The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it and to be it. And that's the way it really is.